Somehow, between the abstract and the program, I lost all of my my colleagues, but there they are. It's something quite ironic as a New Yorker to be standing in San Francisco talking about disaster ethics when my friends and neighbors are underwater without power. I just got an email from the Department of Health looking for volunteers for shelters, and there's one right up the block from me. So, but here I am, right? My cat did just send me a text, though, to let me know he's okay. It really is. I think it's striking when you think about, you know, public health folks, health departments, public health folks, all of us, have thought a lot about disaster preparedness. And certainly post-September 11th and Hurricane Katrina and the earthquake in Haiti and now our newest hurricane, I think we've taken it even more seriously. And clearly September 11th experienced a loss of life that gratefully we have not experienced with this hurricane. On the other hand, the stock exchange did not close for more than one day, and the subways were running, including the subways under the World Trade Center site, far more quickly than it appears they're going to be running this time. So it's a pretty bad emergency. So these are my colleagues. I was the co-director of a project. Dr. Rios is an emergency medicine and palliative care physician. Dr. Redliner was working as an EMS fellow for the Fire Department of the City of New York. Dr. Kohlhoff is a pediatric intensivist and a pediatric infectious disease person, excuse me. Dr. Choi is one of our chief residents in emergency medicine. Dr. Rennett is also an emergency medicine physician. And Dr. Aquila and Patty Roblin run our disaster preparedness program. So if you look at the literature in public health ethics around disasters, you know, no matter how one analyzes it, of course, we use a justice perspective on allocating our scarce resources. And that is kind of where it all comes down. And what we wanted to do is to design a project, or it was a working symposium really as a first step, to see if we could really force people to triage. Because we say, well, Alec, we'll use the principle of justice, we'll allocate resources fairly, but when push comes to shove and you've got patients in front of you, what are you going to do? So that's where this project came from. It was, we held this meeting in March. It was sponsored by my division and the New York Institute for All Hazard Preparedness, which is housed at Downstate, in our division of disaster medicine. And we brought together a few under, about 40, 37 to be exact, folks from emergency medicine, disaster preparedness, palliative care. I was particularly interested in that, public health on the city, state, and national level. And ethics folks, two of whom are in this room, raise your hand. Craig Klugman and Sean Philpott were there, and Bruce Jennings is also part of this SPIG. And what we did was we did some plenary stuff and had some group, you know, large group discussion. But then we broke people into three groups for a small group exercise that forced them to deal with a scenario. And the challenges of this scenario, I think, were to put together a scenario that would be believable, you know, not one of these, oh my God, that would never happen kind of things, which actually we all know that there's nothing you can construct that would be that. But we wanted to have something that would people could say, yeah, well, you know what, that could really happen. And so here's our scenario. The setting was Central Brooklyn. It was actually at Downstate, 440 Lenox Road. I'll show you a picture of that building in a minute. And they happen to have a biotech incubator lab adjacent to that building. And it occurred exactly on the day that we had our meeting. So the building is multifunctional. It's residential, has business space in it, and technology, including some of the IT servers for the medical center. It has 96 apartments, 14 per floor. The basement houses the University Daycare Center with four teachers, 10 teacher aides, and 63 infants and children, ranging from 6 months to 4 years old. The ground and second floors of the building are for business use, including the Student and Employee Health Center and the Student Psychiatric Counseling Center, as well as other offices such as discharge planning and the emergency preparedness offices. And there are 2 to 10 persons in each office space. Floors 3 to 10 have families, with 25% of the occupants being children, 25% senior citizens, and we didn't have any additional information available on those residents other than those broad demographics. So that's the building. I really wish that I was as talented as our emergency medicine resident who actually blew the building up in the next slide. It was pretty, people were like, whoa. But I can't do that, and I don't think APHA had the technology to allow me to do that either, so you'll have to imagine that this building just blew up. So the time at zero, there's an explosion at 440 Lennox Road with extensive damage to the building. It was kind of in the middle of the building. There was no elevator service as a result of that. There was a fire at the site of the explosion very near the entrance to the daycare center. Here's some people. They're not running fast enough, I don't think, but you get the gist. People come out of the building. There are two patients who immediately present to the emergency department at University Hospital requiring immediate resuscitation. These patients are critical. They're not black tagged. We haven't kind of gotten into, and we spent some time going over the process that the EMS and the fire department use to tag people. Black tag meaning you walk away from those people because you know no matter what you can do, they will not survive. So these people were not black tagged. We're at time 0.03 to 0.05 here. We're not very far into this. And they require a lot of resources because of their critical illness. State University Police and the NYPD are present at the scene. And as the NYPD arrives, there's another explosion that occurs with damages to the outside wall of the building and a lot of windows blowing out. So here's a map. The little red A you probably can't see on the bottom is where that building is. You can see that it is a densely populated part of central Brooklyn. there are two hospitals there. There's one up in the kind of in the middle on the upper third. That's our big city hospital. And then there's another one, which is our university hospital, between the city hospital and the building that blew up. So 0.09, FDNY dispatches the fire companies, their ladders, their rescue trucks, and they'll address the fire, evaluate the integrity of the structure, and begin the hazmat efforts. And there are ambulances that are deployed, and the HazTech rescue medical director units respond. So at the same time, four additional patients arrive at the emergency room in critical condition, again, not having been black tagged and requiring extensive resources. And some of the walking wounded start to stumble out of the building. The victims are coughing and complaining of chest tightness. And then staff members start to show up at the emergency room, as well as people from the community, with questions about missing family members. And again, this is a pretty fast-moving scenario. We're not very far into this yet. So here's the status of our emergency department and inpatient units. You can all relate to this, right? Basically, we're 100% full before this happens. Okay, our emergency is people waiting to be seen in the ER. Our ICUs are full. Our inpatient beds are full, and our there's a bunch of pediatric patients. So this is a not unusual scenario for a hospital in the city. And this is before anybody from the incident. And this is the status of our city hospital. Fairly similar, not quite 100% capacity, but fairly similar. There's not a lot of ICU beds. There's not a lot of ventilators, and this is the reality of the world we live in. So at this time, a researcher from the biotech incubator lab calls. Remember I said there was a biotech incubator next to this building, and reports release of a toxic agent he was working on for Defense Department and provides information on the agent. He confirms a likely loss of containment of a highly lethal toxic weapon, XYZ, and precautionary actions are taken and they close the airspace. Ventilators are in short supply. And initial reports from the victims are of respiratory distress, and the police department puts up perimeters. So we're now quarantined. So basically the idea here is that you can't cop out and say we're going to wait for more ambulances, we're going to get more people, they can't come in, you can't go out, and you're going to deal with what you've got. So here's Agent XYZ, a neurotoxin irreversibly binding to nicotinic and muscarinic receptors and causes death within 24 hours, even with treatment in 75% of patients. Atropine, which is a known antidote, must be given within 5 minutes or it's no longer functional. Decontamination efforts will only increase the symptoms and the spread since it aerosolizes the toxin. So here's our victims. I know, right? Well, here's our victims. The first one is Captain S. Captain S is an NYPD officer, recently off duty and on her way home, and she passes by right after the explosion and begins to lend aid to the initial victims. As more help arrives, she herself begins to feel short of breath. As she is helping rescue workers lift a piece of rubble off of a victim, she collapses and begins to seize. She's transported via EMS to the emergency department. On arrival, her vital signs indicate distress. She is diaphoretic, her pupils are pinpoint, excessive salivation, lacrimation, and incontinence of urine. Her physical exam is consistent with severe exposure to the toxin, and it is clear she will need immediate interventions to survive, if at all. Here's Dr. C. She's our second victim. She's 30 years old and an attending physician in the emergency room. She's 28 weeks pregnant with her first baby. She has worked all day and hasn't gotten a chance to have lunch. And she's rushing to the break room a little bit after the explosion to just try and grab a snack and so she can keep going, and she's hit with a stretcher. She falls to the floor, grabs her abdomen, and experiences sharp uterine pain and begins to bleed vaginally. As she loses consciousness, she begs her colleagues to save her baby. Now, I got to tell you that one of the Clarissa Rios, the emergency medicine and palliative care doc who was part of my team, was actually this person. I called her. I said, "Clarissa, can I make you this pregnant lady?" And she said, "Sure, go for it." Mr. M is, at the time of the explosion, 20 men are standing outside a nearby homeless shelter. Approximately 60 minutes later, the group begins to exhibit signs of toxic exposure, and several of them pass out. Mr. M stumbles into the emergency room with mild respiratory distress and agitation, which he says began 10 minutes ago. He is in his mid-50s and is well known to the emergency room staff. He is a frequent flyer in the emergency room, as they say. His blood pressure and heart rate are elevated. His respirations are shallow. He's got bilateral wheezes, no visible signs of trauma. But he's slightly agitated but oriented to person and place. Next, we have a toddler. Toddler B is 3 years old. He was in the daycare center. He happens to be the grandson of the dean. And he was recovered from the rubble with trauma to the chest wall and in respiratory distress. And then there's Grandma. Grandma is 75 years old. She lives in the building with her daughter and her three grandchildren. She has renal disease but has refused dialysis in the past. Her daughter's an NICU nurse at University Hospital and a widow because her husband was killed in Iraq. And she's the primary caretaker of the children. She's got one of them with her when she goes to the daycare center to try to get, she's going to pick up one. She's got the other two with her. The force of the explosion knocks her down, and she covers the children from the falling debris. During the blast, a large piece of concrete strikes her head, and she's knocked out. She and the children are brought to the emergency room. The kids are crying, and she's unconscious. She's bradycardic, hypertensive, and her right pupil is fixed and dilated. She has a large hematoma over her right temple, and as she's being entered into the emergency room medical record, she begins to breathe agonally. So that's our five patients, and we forced people to triage. And here we're our, so basically all of the patients will die without intervention. Perhaps some of them will die with intervention. Should they be black tagged given the situation, or who should we put first? And here are our results. We had three groups. And there's a fair amount of consistency, and people really, these groups' discussions were really, really interesting. So basically, the three groups were very similar in their triage results. If you look, you can see that the top two were the doctor and the toddler, and grandma, unfortunately, was on the bottom for everybody. And the other, there's a little bit of discussion about what the homeless guy versus the police officer and why. The blue and the yellow groups triaged Dr. C first. I don't think she'd know if she was in those groups, since her condition was not due to the toxin and the blood loss was potentially stabilizable or reversible, not reversible, but stabilizable. Also, saving her would potentially save two lives. There was some concern about whether there would be people around to actually take care of this premature infant. The toddler had priority as the youngest, with the longest potential lifespan and the best possible quality of life if he survived. Respiratory symptoms were potentially reversible because they might have been related more to the you could put it in a chest tube perhaps and get him breathing again rather than to the toxin. Captain S was ranked third by two groups, balancing the severity of her clinical presentation with her uniform status as a police officer. One group ranked her fourth, basing their decision on clinical presentation rather than social utility. Mr. M would be treated before Grandma, despite a lesser perception of usefulness to society, as his condition was not as severe and potentially was reversible with rapid treatment. And there was consensus that Grandma would be triaged last because her age, likely comorbidities, and extensive trauma, but it was really the trauma, would preclude a good outcome and not justify use of resources, and palliative care should be employed. So our key recommendations were clear, easy to follow, transparent, and equitable crisis standards of care, that during a mass casualty incident, one person who's removed from direct patient care and has bioethics and leadership training should make the triage decisions rather than the people actually providing the care. Training and drills need to exercise the leadership skills of people like that in terms of making ethical treatment decisions. There should be participation of a palliative care team during a crisis and disaster situations, and that could expand options. And that's actually one of the things we want to look at moving forward. The roles of community members during disasters should be defined, and ongoing training at hospitals should include the community at large. Community involvement prior to catastrophic events is critical for them to understand the basis for ethical decision making. Mental health support should be provided to those involved as treatment people or responders, including post-incident stress debriefing for hospital staff. Maximizing resource reallocation should be included in the discussion so that opportunities for recruiting additional support are not missed. And I think that's it. The idea is that that it would be a person who was a disaster, a clinician who also had training in bioethics.
Oh, okay.
And/or a clinician working with somebody in bioethics. But basically you need both of those sets of skills.
Okay.
Right. I don't know. Craig, do you or Sean want to say anything to that? He's chewing pop rocks. No. I'm glad you clarified that.
It would be somebody who's a clinical ethics consultant, so they're aware of the terminology, the players in the field. It would have to be somebody that is known to the people at EMS as well as the hospital, because otherwise, if it's just some strange person you walk in, they have no reason to even expect this person to do it. But basically, if you needed somebody that was removed from, because all these care providers are interested in their patient.
Right.
And you need somebody.
And they need to be.
The global perspective of looking at all these people and making the hard decision.
Don't worry, you'll get invited to the next round.
And I also have a plug. I leave in a minute because at 2:30 there's a presentation based on the use of medicine, breast centers, really interesting. I actually disagree about a clinical ethics, and the Institute of Medicine does not make that specific recommendation, although we're not far. Clearly, ethics is all the knowledge.
That's where we were going. That we need, you need both, And I think and Sean actually came back and did another round of education with our EM emergency medicine people around public health ethics principles, because the idea is that the most important thing is that somebody removed from the actual patient in front of them, and that they are trained both as leaders, you know, ridiculously often responsibility, and that they have ethics training. But you know, it might involve if you have an ethics person, but you need those things need to be part of the decision making. Yeah.
I'm just struggling to see how it would work in practice, because obviously the situation would change from minute to minute, possibly. So how would that work? How could you want that person not to be sitting in some little office making those bioethical decisions, but how would they be updated on changing? How could it work?
Well, that's part of the challenge, isn't it? You have to keep reevaluating. And one of the ethical questions that we did not address, I think, because this was a first step, and that I think people struggle with, is if you've already got people on the ventilators, will you take them off to put somebody else on who is more likely to survive? And I think that's a challenge.
Mm-hmm.